Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in the current healthcare debate, obesity is sometimes blamed for helping to drive the rise in healthcare costs. But did you know that there's a fat studies movement taking aim at government policies and pop culture representations of obesity in an effort to change the discourse about fat? And now academics and activists have produced a definitive compilation about the historical construction of fatness and an up-to-date look at fat studies research. It is called the Fat Studies Reader, which will be published by the NYU Press in November. The editors of the book are both with me now. Esther Rothblum, a professor of women's studies at San Diego State University. She's the editor of several books, including Overcoming Fear of Fat. And Sandra Solovey, an attorney who Fat Legal Advocacy Rights and Education Project. Let me say that right. The Fat Legal Advocacy Rights and Education Project. She's the author of Tipping the Scales of Justice, Fighting Weight-Based Discrimination. So Esther and Sandra, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And first off, Esther, we are supposed to use the word fat, right? This has been reclaimed by the movement?
That's right. You know, the word fat is it focuses exactly on what we are looking at, and that's body fat. For example, if we just talk about weight, somebody who's tall and thin may actually weigh more than somebody who's short and fat. And also, if you think about elite athletes like Serena Williams, the tennis star, she has a lot more muscle, let's say, than someone who doesn't play tennis, so she would weigh more. But fat studies scholars use that term just the way that other oppressed groups have reclaimed words, like people of African descent reclaim the word black, and some young, you know, gay men and lesbians are reclaiming the word queer. So what words like fat and black and queer have in common is people are saying, let's take a word that really says who we are, perhaps even a word that's been used negatively, and let's reclaim it.
Well, we have a history, Sandra Solovey, of increasing obesity in the United States, to the point where now the National Institutes of Health defines over 60% of Americans as overweight or obese, and my point being that that's a lot more than it used to be. So if we're going to look at fatness as in the category of civil rights and say that it's like being black or it's like being queer, can we really go there, since this is something that obviously behavior is causing?
Well, first of all, I don't agree with your assumption that this is something that behavior is causing.
It's at least for a large percentage of obese people. Is that not accurate?
No, I think it's way more complicated than that simple sentence. And I know that the discourse that people have about weight makes it seem just that simple. Calories in, calories out. Don't sit on the couch. Don't eat donuts. You'll be thin. But in fact, there have always been fat people, and there always will be fat people. And what we do is we change the definitions of who is fat. Literally overnight, the definition of who is fat was changed several years ago, around the time when my first book was coming out, so that people who went to bed not fat woke up fat, just because we changed how we define that. So,
but the definition of diabetes hasn't changed, has it? And we're seeing much more.
Actually, it has, Brian.
Go ahead.
The numbers that have been used to define people who are diabetic or pre-diabetic have actually changed. These are really good. These are exactly the kinds of assumptions that we need the field of fat studies to look at and question.
So,
but your larger question was really about can there be a disenfranchised group if that group is getting to be more numerous in terms of people? And absolutely, there absolutely can be. And you have to look no further than looking at women. Obviously, women have faced and continue to face disproportionate disadvantage in a lot of ways. And the fact that women make up half or more than half of the population hasn't stopped that.
So certainly people who are fat for whatever reason could be discriminated against in ways that should be seen as unlawful, in ways that should be seen just as not nice. But let me keep challenging you, Esther Rothblum, even on the title of your book, for example, Overcoming Fear of Fat. Isn't there very good reason for individuals to fear, and I'm just talking strict health concerns, to fear becoming fat, and that you don't want to enable people to engage in very unhealthy behaviors for their own benefit?
Two things. The title Fear of Fat, that book, referred to the fact that so many people, especially girls and women, but even boys and men, are terrified of gaining weight, even people who are very thin. And as you know, another epidemic in our country has been eating disorders like anorexia, right? So that book really focused on the fact that we are all made to feel very scared of gaining weight, regardless, really, of our weight. But in terms of the health risks, I also want to point out a fact that is very interesting, and that is that we are living so much longer than people used to. So just for example, the life expectancy for people born in 1930 was 58 years for men and 62 years for women. Now, the life expectancy for people born in the year 2004 is 75 years for men and 80 years for women. That's about a 20-year difference. So we are outliving our thinner grandparents by 20 years. That's almost a whole generation. So what we see in the media is, on the one hand, there'll be an article about a man dies in Britain at the age of 113. You may have seen that a couple of weeks ago. And then on the same page, you know, obesity causes health problems. So I'm just fascinated with this idea of our longevity and how much we're ignoring, really, that good news.
But are you using statistics unscientifically there? Certainly, as a society, people in the United States are living longer than they did in the past. But if you compare, let's say, a 50-year-old 5'9" man who's 150 pounds and a 50-year-old 5'9" man who's 250 pounds, you're not going to have the same life expectancy from that point.
Well, one very interesting thing about weight and health is that in this country particularly, I mean, in Western countries in general, but most of all in the U.S., fat people tend to be poor and rich people tend to be thin. It's a very strong relationship. And I say to my students, you know, you can almost replace the word poor with the word fat. So when we hear things like fat people cost the nation $147 billion or whatever we're reading, just say poor people cost the nation $147 billion. In other words, we know, especially in the U.S., where we don't have national health care, that poor people don't have the same resources. If you actually look at fat people who are wealthy, you get a very different picture, but of course that's a very small percentage. So it's important to keep that in mind. We're talking not only about fat and thin people, we're talking about poor and rich people.
My guests, Esther Rothblum and Sandra Solovey, they are the editors of a new book called The Fat Studies Reader, being used in fat studies courses in academia. And we can take your phone calls for them, no matter your weight. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Sandra, to follow up on what Esther was just saying, there is a social justice piece of the obesity discussion. Lower income people are more likely to be overweight, which is linked to limited food options in poorer communities. Cheap food is usually highly processed food, which is high and in fat and sugar. But then does the fat studies argument for normalizing obesity undermine the social justice argument for equal access to fresh food and healthy food options?
That is such a great question, and absolutely not. In fact, a mainstay of the movement is health at every size, and that means increasing healthy options for people of all sizes and increasing lifestyle behaviors that contribute to health for people of all sizes. So in other words, I teach law and I do a lot of trainings for attorneys for continuing education in California. And when I do these trainings, invariably I get people come up to me after, and they are thin people. You absolutely would not identify them on the street as being fat in any way, but they have experienced the flip side of weight discrimination. So, for example, one woman who came up to me, very thin woman, who had undiagnosed diabetes that wreaked havoc in her life for many years. Well, she faced the opposite side of the stereotype. She went to the doctor's office. No one even thought it could be diabetes that was causing the problems for her. On the other hand, I've had thin men come in who maybe are very muscular, and they've faced difficulties because they wanted to be firefighters or policemen, and they hit that weight requirement. In other words, their weight exceeded it, not because they were fat, but because they were muscular, and so they faced weight discrimination. I even had a woman call who worked in the women's fashion magazine industry, and she was a size 4'6", which, as you know, is well under the average U.S. American women's size. But she was facing weight discrimination because the people in her office were sizes 0 to 2.
Well, I'm sure all that's true. But back to the question that I asked about whether the fat studies argument for normalizing obesity undermines the social justice argument for equal access to fresh food and healthy food options. Because if you're going to make the poor people argument, then it seems to follow that if there is more fresh food available, if there are more healthy food affordable options, then you're going to wind up having less obesity in the low-income communities, and that would be a good thing. But it sounds like you don't want to even say that would be a good thing because that undermines your civil rights argument.
No, it doesn't. First of all, I don't think that's what would happen. I think we would have healthier people, but I don't think that we would have significantly, we might have a slightly lower weight or slightly higher weight, I'm not sure, but it wouldn't be significantly different. I mean, I don't know. I'd love to see it happen. That's how we would know. If everyone could access fresh, locally grown food easily, and if it were cheaper to do that than to go to fast food chain, that would be fantastic. But I don't think that's going to change the civil rights issue. And what I'm saying is the discrimination we face based on weight happens to people of all sizes. So we need to eradicate weight discrimination, period. I absolutely wholeheartedly support healthy foods for people. I've been a vegetarian almost my entire life. It hasn't made me thin, but I've been a committed vegetarian since I was 11 years old. So there is a real importance to increase access to good, nutritious food for people regardless of their size.
Matt,
and the
same
thing for accessing insurance, so that people can of all sizes can afford insurance and get preventative care instead of showing up in the emergency room where it costs people more money, costs everyone more money. And the crux of that is changing attitudes at the doctor's office so that large people don't face discrimination when they go in to see health professionals, because that discourages people from getting the preventative care that can stop problems in the long run.
Sandra Salove and Esther Rothblum, co-editors of the Fat Studies Reader, and Matt in Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I just, going back to the question you gave, it was an excellent example. You had two individuals, let's say two males, 5'9", one 150 pounds, one 250 pounds. And there is a behavior associated with that. There's numerous studies showing when Americans go overseas and live in Spain and France, they lose weight and become more healthier. When individuals from Europe and the Far East come to the United States and their eating habits change, or they change their eating habits, they again gain weight and become less healthier. Does not verify that it is a behavior? Do you not admit it's part behavior at the least?
Esther?
You know, there are many countries that argue that they are the fattest nation. The U.S. does, Canada does, Australia does, Britain does, Germany does. I'm sure there are others. And we're not even in the top 20. The World Health Organization keeps data of the, height and weight across the world. And the countries that really exceed us in terms of weight are many of the Pacific Island nations and also a few countries in the Middle East. But the reason I think there's this sort of myth that, the Western countries, especially the U.S., is fat and people who move here will gain weight, it's very much in the interest of the corporations that stand to gain, no pun intended, about that. I think one of the reasons that the caller is saying that people who immigrate gain weight is they're often coming from very impoverished situations. And, of course, when they're here, they gain weight. When Americans
But we also
go to
see
Europe,
studies like women who come from Japan, families who come from Japan, in the first generation here, there's a much greater incidence of heart disease and cancer than there was in their families back there. And I don't think science has completely teased that out, but it has to do with lifestyle, correct?
Well, I think, again, there's so many factors. One of them, of course, is they have less access to health care when they're here. You know, they don't have the national health care that they would have in Japan. But as you can see, these are complicated, interesting issues. These are the kinds of things a lot of our authors focus on in the Fat Studies Reader.
But to follow up on his question, which followed up on my question, I'm still trying to get a little bit at how much you're in denial here about some of the health differentials. So to go back to that example and the answer that you gave me before, 50-year-old, 150-pound male, 50-year-old, 250-pound male, and their relative life expectancies. You said earlier that so much of life expectancy has to do with income, so that if that person, if one of those people is well off, well, if you had a, let's say you have a 250-pound well-off person and a 150-pound poor person, 50-year-old males, 5'9", they're not going to be that much different in life expectancy just based on weight if they're having the same income. Do you know any stats on that you can actually cite to tell us how different or how not different?
Yeah, well, not how different or how not different for one person, but the country does keep statistics on height and weight, and if you look at income, that's a big factor. So we very rarely have the situation of two people in the same income level. I also want to add one more factor to that, and that is the way that heavier people are treated when they go to see their doctor. There's a number of studies on that, and there even are cases of people who are heavier who don't want to go see their doctor because of how they're treated. So even though I would say I'm on the same page with doctors in terms of everybody should have access to good food, everybody should have access to fun activities and exercise, where I think doctors have to be careful is not to make fatter people feel bad to the point that they're not coming in for treatment or prevention.
Christine in Kew Gardens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christine.
Hi, it's Kristen.
I'm sorry.
I just had actually weight loss surgery about 2 weeks ago. I have dieted my entire life, and I think that there's something that we're missing here, and that I think something a lot of thin people miss when they look at obese people like myself. I think that what happens often is we forget that if you take that 150-pound man and 250-pound man, they may eat exactly the same. They may both eat poorly, or they may both eat very well, but sometimes in that situation, one will end up obese and one will stay skinny. And I'd love your guest to speak to that genetic predisposition that people have that I think thin people miss. And because of that, we get social repercussions. And it's very, very frustrating as a woman who has done everything in her life to try to be thin, including eating right and exercising.
Who wants to talk about genetics? Esther, Sandra, who wants
it? Well, I think Kristen has a very good point that one of the things also when we talk about fat people should become thin is fat people can't get thin. That so the 98% of diets result in people losing weight, but in the long run, putting it back on, sometimes actually putting on more weight than they had to start with. So unfortunately, what we often see in the media is that 2% of people who manage to keep the weight off, and without any recognition of how unusual that is, you know, if that were the case for, let's say, a medication, doctors would not expect people to take something that would only work for 2% of the population. And a good example of this is smoking. When I first became a professor in the early 80s, many of the professors I knew were smoking cigarettes. We even had a cigarette vending machine in the basement of our building. And now, 20 years later, 30 years later, almost everybody has quit smoking except for one or two of them. So these people have willpower. We know how hard it is to quit. But they've also been dieting, and they lose weight, and they regain it, and they lose it, and they regain it. So there's something about weight that is very different, that even people with willpower who can quit smoking are not able to do.
Let me go out with a pop culture question, because I see that there's an essay in the Fat Studies Reader about the chick lit genre of fiction, which is a genre mostly written by women for women and often featuring fat heroines, not only looking for love, but also looking to be at peace with their bodies. Is this the pop culture antidote to the impossibly thin women we see on TV?
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great to have fat characters in fiction. And actually, the Fat Studies Reader includes chapters on chick lit, you know, for younger women, theater, television, celebrities who lose weight and then regain it, and so on. But you're right, wouldn't it be great if we could see people who look like us? And us refers to almost the entire population. What we see in the media, and including in chick lit, is often very, very thin main characters. Mm.
Is the tide turning, though? We've seen a Dove ad recently, Dove ad campaign recently featuring larger women. 30 seconds. Is the tide turning?
Yes, the tide is turning to some extent, but on the other hand, we're facing increased discrimination. So I think we are nearing a tipping point, but like other movements, there has been a backlash.
Esther Rothblum, professor of women's studies at San Diego State. Sandra Solovey, an attorney with the Fat Legal Advocacy Rights and Education Project. They are the co-editors of the Fat Studies Reader. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Since I was in my braces, water in a hole with the girls around and curves in all the right places. Big girls, you are beautiful. Big girls, you are beautiful. Big girls, you are beautiful. Big girls, you are beautiful.
Walks into the room. It's Mika, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.